buttons. Okay. All right. So Romans. Yeah? Romans chapter 10. So last time we talked about Romans chapter 9, and one thing that I don't think I said, but I meant to, was that Paul was really giving the case for the fact that God has the right to choose the terms of the covenant, right? It's his covenant, so he's choosing the terms. And really the trouble, a lot of the trouble that the Jews have is, well, you know, we're the chosen people, so therefore we should get all the blessing. And Paul is saying, "Nah, it's not quite how it works. You have to understand how God is choosing the terms of his covenant that he is making with the world. And it's not just with the Jews." So Paul's going to continue that argument in chapter 10. So, Romans chapter 10, verse 1, "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. For Moses writes about the righteousness that is based on the law, that the person who does the commandments shall live by them. But the righteousness based on faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith that we proclaim. Because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. For the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. How then will they call on him whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? So faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. But I ask, have they not heard? Indeed they have. For their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. But I ask, did Israel not understand? First Moses said, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation, and with a foolish nation I will make you angry. Then Isaiah is so bold as to say, I have been found by those who did not seek me, and I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. But of Israel, he says, all day long I have held out my hands to a disobedient and contrary people. So, he has to start over and say, I promise you, I really do want Jews to be saved, right? So he did that at the beginning of chapter 9, and he does it again at the beginning of chapter 10. And why is that? Why is he going out of his way to say, brothers, my heart's desire is that they may be saved? We talked about this a little bit last time, but why do you think he goes out of his way twice to say, I really want the Jews to be saved? There's a few reasons. You can pick one. Absolutely, absolutely. He's gone through 9 chapters now saying, you got it wrong, you got it wrong, you got it wrong, you got it wrong, you got it wrong. Right? So he's beating up the Jews. He's doing a good job beating up the Jews. So he says, but I don't want you to think that I don't want them to be saved. I don't want you to think that God doesn't want them to be saved. So absolutely. Is there anything else? Not that you can think of. Anything, anyone else think of anything? If you don't say something, then Mike is going to.
It's true.
You're doing it to yourself. No. All right, what's cooking in your head?
So one of the things that's interesting is that throughout this whole book, he's reminded them, and we've said this before, does this mean that the law doesn't matter? Does this mean that the law is unimportant? And so he's saying, don't forget that the law does matter, and it is something to be a Jew. So he wants to remind them before he completely tears down all distinction that you do have a special role to play.
Right, exactly. Exactly, thank you. So throughout this whole thing, Paul is not trying to make the argument that it's no but, right? He's not saying no to everything that is Jewish, but now there's this other thing that you need to know about. He's saying yes and. Yes, everything that you understand, yes, and there's more, right? So exactly what you said, he wants to establish the fact that yes, the Jews are God's chosen people. Yes, they have special blessing. Yes, they have a covenant that is unique to them. Yes, all of that is true. And guess what? The Gentiles can come in too. So let's keep reading. So, actually I'm going to back up to chapter 9 verse 30 real quick. What should we say then? That the Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness have attained it. That is a righteousness that is by faith. But that Israel who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness did not succeed in reaching that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as if it were based on works. They have stumbled over the stumbling stone. As it is written, behold, I'm laying in Zion a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame. Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God. And kind of ironic talking coming from Paul, right? I mean, you want to talk about being zealous for God but not having a clue. I mean, his story when he was Saul before the road to Damascus, where, you know, he's killing Christians because of his zeal for God, right? So I bear witness that Jews have zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. So that word end does not mean like the finish line, like the, or the, like it's over, like it stops, okay? It doesn't mean end in that way, although it sort of does. What it really means is it's the point, it's the goal, it's the purpose, right? So that's the word telos, which is, you know, why is something happening? Why do we have the law? Christ, right? Christ is the end. He's the point of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. He's the completion of the law, yes, but he's also the point and the purpose of the law, right? So Christ is the whole point for righteousness to everyone who believes. For Moses writes about the righteousness that is based on the law, that the person who does the commandments shall live by them. And we already saw that in chapter 2 when he goes through and says, well, if you really want to pick that way, that's what you have to do. You have to be perfect. You have to follow the law letter by letter. But the righteousness based on faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven or who will descend into the abyss. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. So he's quoting here from Deuteronomy. So let's go back. I want to get a running start at this because this is another one where Paul gives you this little snapshot. So go to Deuteronomy, actually chapter 29. Paul gives us this little tiny snapshot and says, see, it's just like this, right? But he's presupposing that the Jews understand the whole picture and the whole context of what's going on when he pulls these verses out. And a lot of times, you know, we just read them over and like, oh, that's cute. And then I go and like read the cross reference because I've got the little, you know, there's a little P. And so I like, what does the P mean? Oh, it means Deuteronomy 30. Okay, so let me go read that. And then you read that verse and then you're like, okay, he quoted from the Old Testament. Super. And then keep on going. Right? But so Paul is assuming or presupposing that the Jews understand the context of what this was going on. So let's get some of the context. So Deuteronomy chapter 29, these are the words, this is of course Moses speaking, these are the words of the covenant that the Lord commanded Moses to make with the people of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant that he had made to them at Horeb. So this is God renewing his covenant again. He does that a lot. Okay? And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "You have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, the great trials that your eye saw, the signs and those great wonders. But to this day, the Lord has not given you a heart to understand or eyes to see or ears to hear. I have led you 40 years in this wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out on you. Your sandals have not worn off your feet. You have not eaten bread, and you have not drunk wine or strong drink, that you may know that I am the Lord your God." Stop there just for a second. I was thinking about this, when I was going back to read this. If you think about, if you went for 40 years without ever having to buy clothes, like, not only would that be cool, awesome, I don't have to buy clothes, you would be fantastically wealthy. Do you realize how rich you would be? Like, if the stuff that normally wears out didn't wear out and you never had to replace it, you could take all the resources that you put towards, you know, like, here they are. They don't have to buy clothes. They don't have to make clothes. They don't have to make sandals. They can take all those resources and divert that towards something else, right? So I just randomly. It's not only is it cool that your clothes don't wear out, but now you have all those other resources. Anyway, that was free. All right, verse 7. "And when you came to this place, Sihon the king of Heshbon and Og the king of Bashan came out against us to battle, but we defeated them. We took their land and gave it for an inheritance to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half tribe of Manasseh. And therefore, keep the words of this covenant and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do. You are standing today, all of you, before the Lord your God, the heads of your tribes, your elders and your officers, all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and the sojourner who is in your camp. From the one who chops your wood to the one who draws your water, so that you may enter into the sworn covenant of the Lord your God, which the Lord your God is making with you today." It's another point there. He includes everyone. Men, women, children, of high rank, of low rank, and even the stranger, the non-Jewish sojourner who is in your camp, he's making the covenant with everyone equally, that he may establish you today as his people, and that he may be your God, as he promised you, and as he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. It is not with you alone that I am making this sworn covenant, but with whoever is standing here with us today before the Lord our God, and with whomever is not here with us today. Did you get that? Who did he make the covenant with? Whomever is standing here with us today before the Lord our God, and with whoever is not with us today. That's kind of everybody, isn't it? Anyway, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Okay. "You know how you lived in the land of Egypt and how we came through the midst of the nations through which you passed. And you have seen their detestable things, their idols of wood and stone, of silver and gold, which were among them. Beware, lest there be among you a man or a woman or clan or tribe whose heart is turning away today from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of those nations. Beware, lest there be among you a root bearing poisonous and bitter fruit, one who, when he bears the words of the sworn covenant, blesses himself in his heart, saying, 'I shall be safe, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart.' This will lead to the sweeping away of moist and dry alike. The Lord will not be willing to forgive him, but rather the anger of the Lord and his jealousy will smoke against that man. And the curses written in this book will settle upon him, and the Lord will blot out his name from under heaven. And the Lord will single him out from all the tribes of Israel for calamity. in accordance with all the curses of the covenant written in this book of the law. And the next generation, your children, who rise up after you, and the foreigner who comes from a far land, will say when they see the afflictions of that land and the sickness with which the Lord has made it sick, the whole land burned out with brimstone and salt, nothing sown and nothing growing, where no plant can sprout, an overthrow like that of Sodom and Gomorrah, Adam and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and wrath. All the nations will say, why has the Lord done this to this land? What caused the heat of his great anger? Then people will say, it is because they abandoned the covenant of the Lord, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them up out of the land of Egypt, and went and served other gods and worshipped them, gods whom they had not known and whom he had not allotted to them. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against this land, bringing upon it all the curses written in this book. And the Lord uprooted them from the land in anger and fury and great wrath, and cast them into another land, as they are this day. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. And when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you, and return to the Lord your God, you and your children, and obey his voice in all that I command you today, with all your heart and with all your soul, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you, and he will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. If your outcasts are in the uttermost part of heaven, from there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will take you. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land that your fathers possessed, that you may possess it. And he will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring, so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live. And the Lord your God will put all these curses on your foes and your enemies who persecute you, and you shall again obey the voice of the Lord and keep all his commandments that I command you today. The Lord your God will make you abundantly prosperous in all the work of your hand, in the fruit of your womb, in the fruit of your cattle, and in the fruit of your ground. For the Lord will take delight in prospering you, as he took delight in your fathers. When you obey the voice of the Lord your God to give his commandments, to keep his commandments and his statutes that are written in this book of the law, when you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. For this commandment that I command you today is not too hard for you, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it? Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us to bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it? But the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and it is in your heart, so that you can do it. So that's a lot, but that's the context that Paul is drawing from when he's telling the Jews and the Gentiles, it's more than what you think. Moses writes about the righteousness back in Romans chapter 10, verse 5, for Moses writes about the righteousness that is based on the law, that the person who does the commandments shall live by them, but the righteousness based on faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven? And then Paul says, that is to bring Christ down. Or who will ascend into the abyss? And Paul adds, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. So he is proclaiming the renewed covenant of God with Israel. But if you notice, inside that covenant, God says, I'm not just making this covenant with the people who are here. I'm making this covenant with everyone. And Paul says, that is the word of faith that we proclaim. God's covenant with Israel, God's covenant with the whole world, that is the word of faith that we proclaim. So he's making this tie and saying, everything that you believed, yes, but there's more. It's not just the fact that you are Jews and you are chosen and you're special and that's it. That's not the point. The point is God's covenant is for all mankind. Because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. That's chapter 4, right? It's not by works, it's by faith. Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. Let's see if this is where we need to jump over to Joel. Eventually we're going to go to Joel. So grab and go to Joel. Chapter 2. All right. I think that's not the right time. I always mean to like write stuff down and put markers and I never do it. Let's see. Yeah, this is the right one. Yeah, this is a great one. Okay, so Joel again is another prophet, right? And he's prophesying, not unlike Moses there when we were reading in Deuteronomy where Moses said, you know, this is the covenant if you do everything right, and then if you don't, you're going to get scattered to the four winds, right? And of course that happened. Right? And so Joel is declaring here the return if you go Joel chapter 2 and verse 12, yet even now declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping and mourning, and rend your hearts and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and he relents over disaster. So then skip down because he's gonna keep talking about all of the blessings that are available when you come back and all the things that God is going to do. And then if you skip down to verse 28, and it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions. Even on the male and female servants in those days, I will pour out my spirit. And I will show wonders in the heavens and on earth, blood and fire and columns of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness, the moon to blood, before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be those who escape, as the Lord has said, and among the survivors shall be those whom the Lord calls. So again, we see here is Paul pulling from history, pulling from tradition, pulling from everything the Jews know, and they say, yeah, of course. When the Lord comes and he brings everyone back, And all this happened, he's going to pour out his spirit, and everyone who calls on him are going to be saved, right? We totally get that. We totally accept that. We know that. And what we know is that everyone who is God's chosen people who call on the name of the Lord will be saved, right? That's what the Jews thought. They thought that when it said everyone, well, of course that means every Jew. I mean, it doesn't mean everyone, everyone. It means every Jew, right? That's what the Jews thought. That's what they thought for millennia. They are God's chosen people, and only God's chosen people have the right to call on the name of the Lord and be saved. Even though Joel says everyone. So what does Paul say? He'll go back to Romans 10. Verse 11, for the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. And then he's going to smack him again. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. For the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Not just Jews, and also not just Gentiles. That's why he starts with, my brothers, my heart's desire for Israel is that they'll be saved. I'm not saying the Jews are wrong. I'm saying they're not getting the whole picture. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. But we know, if we're a Jew, that everyone just means God's chosen people, right? It just means God's chosen people. So if you're God's chosen people already, then you can call on him, right? Haha. So Paul says, how then will they call on him in whom they've not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they've never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? So faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. But I ask then, have they not heard? Indeed they have. For the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the end of the world, so they are without excuse, right? So he's quoting from Psalms there, and he's already talked about that in chapter 1. Their voice has gone out to all the earth. But I asked, did not Israel understand? First Moses says, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. With a foolish nation, I will make you angry. Then Isaiah is so bold as to say, I have been found by those who did not seek me. I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. So this whole time, all the way through this chapter, he's making the point that, again, it's not just about being a Jew. So if you were to say, okay, you're going to be a Jew. Every Jew who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. If that was the case, he would not then go and make his next argument in starting in verse 14, where he says, well, how can they call on him unless they're a Jew, right? Or how can they call on him unless they were predestined, or how can they call on him unless they were vessels of mercy, right? He doesn't say any of that. He says, how can they call on him unless in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without a preacher? And how are they to preach unless they were sent? And then he skips down to 16. He says, but they have not all obeyed the gospel. They have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he's heard from us? So who is Isaiah talking about when he says that? Who has obeyed what he's heard? Who's Isaiah talking about when he says that? I know you don't.
Well,
go ahead.
Israel.
Israel, right? Isaiah's speaking to Israel. His whole ministry is to Jews, right? He's a prophet to the Jews. And he's saying to God, who has believed what they've heard? So Paul is saying, Israel has rejected the truth. You've heard it, and you've rejected it. Right? So clearly, again, being a Jew isn't enough. Yet again, Paul keeps coming around and around and around and around to the same thing. Being a Jew is not enough because the Jews heard. Faith comes by hearing, and the Jews heard. And what did they do? They rejected. Right? Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? So then faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. But I ask, have they not heard? Well, maybe the problem is they really just didn't hear. They didn't know any better. But then he says, their voice has gone out to all the earth. Their words to the end of the earth. That's exactly what he was talking about back in chapter 1. Remember, I said if you have questions about the rest of the book, go back to 1 through 3, because the answer is there. So he says, their voice has gone out into all the earth. The glory of God is clearly displayed to the point that man is without excuse. We are without excuse. There's no one that can say, I never knew. I didn't know the truth. I was never presented with it. I never heard that there was such a thing as God. You can't say that. But I asked, did Israel not understand? Moses says, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. And with a foolish nation, I will make you angry. That is so galling to them. Because he's saying, I came to you Jews, I gave you my word, I put it in your heart, I put it in your mouth, and you rejected it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to show you what you should have done. And who's going to teach that to you? Not the chosen, not the precious, but the outcasts, right? The godless people, the people, they aren't even a nation. You can't even call them a lineage. You can't even call them a tribe. They're not even that established. They don't have all of the benefits that you have being the chosen children of God and all of this history. They don't even have that. And yet they can show you the truth and they're going to make you jealous. And with a foolish nation, well, there's someone who have a history, they have been established, right? But they weren't established as Jews. They're a Gentile nation. And with them, I'm going to make you angry. And then Isaiah is so bold as to say, I've been found by those who did not seek me, and I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. But of Israel, he says, all the day long I have held out my hands to a disobedient and contrary people. And that goes right into chapter 11. I ask then, has God rejected his people? It's not possible, because I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Right? So he's saying that Israel has rejected the truth that God gave to Israel. Right? But God hasn't rejected Israel. Why is that? Huh? Who? Because he promised. Right? God swore by himself that he wouldn't reject his people. That he would make them a nation forever. And he swore by himself. It's by his own character. So Israel rejects God, but God does not reject Israel. In fact, all day long, he says, I've held out my hands to this disobedient and contrary people. I know that they are running away from me. I know that they are against me in every way. They're rejecting everything that I am trying to do, everything that I'm trying to show them. And what am I doing? I'm still holding out my hands. I'm still calling them back. Right? But who did he make this covenant with, according to Deuteronomy? Everyone. The people who are here and the people who are not here. Everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So again, to reinforce, he goes on in the beginning of chapter 11. So I ask, has God rejected his people? It's not possible, because I'm a Jew. Right? It's not possible that God has rejected the Jewish nation because Paul is a Jew. And he says, I'm a descendant of Abraham. I'm a member of the tribe of Benjamin. I've got credit, right? God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Don't you know what the scripture says of Elijah, how he appeals to God against Israel? Lord, they have killed your prophets. They have demolished your altars, and I alone have been left, and I seek my life. But what does God reply to him? Calm down, princess. I got this. I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So too, at this present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. But if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. What then? Israel failed to attain what it was seeking. The chosen obtained it, but the rest were hardened. As it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that would not see and ears that would not hear down to this very day. And David says, let their table become a snare and a trap, a stumbling block and a retribution for them. Let their eyes be darkened so they cannot see and bend their backs forever. So here is Paul saying again, it's not on the basis of works. It's not on the basis of being a Jew. It's not on the basis of following the law. It's on the basis of God's grace. God's grace. Right? So Israel failed to attain what it was seeking, but we learned last week or last time why did they fail? Right? Why did Israel not attain the righteousness that they were searching for? Chapter 9, verse 31, but Israel, who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness, did not succeed in reaching that law. Verse 32, why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as if it were based on works. They stumbled over the stumbling stone. So, Israel failed to attain it, because they didn't pursue it by faith, but as if they were trying to attain it through works. The elect, the chosen, obtained it, but the rest were hardened. God gave them eyes that would not see and ears that would not hear down to this very day. And David says, well, let their table become a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a retribution. Let their eyes be darkened so they cannot see and bend their backs forever. So what's going on here? How does this come about? You may say that it's between the chosen, the elect, and those who are hardened, those who are not chosen or elect, right? So how is the distinction made? We've done this one before too. Did you? No, you're just moving your hair. All right. All right, don't brush your hair. I'm going to call on you. No. All right, so how does this come to be? Remember, if you have a question of what Romans 9 through 11 is saying, go back to Romans 1 through 3, right? So how is it that these people become hardened? Does God harden people's hearts? Have we talked about that? No, we didn't. I forgot that part. Guesses?
So it's Romans 1, what we talked about is the first, you see the truth of God, but then you reject it.
Yeah.
And because you have rejected the truth of God, you have to exchange, you have to put something in that place. So you put something else in the place of God and pursue that, and God eventually gives you over to that and allows you to destroy yourself.
Absolutely.
For the purpose of seeing that, then you come back.
Exactly right. Full circle, right? So the point is that they first are confronted with the truth and then they reject it. Right? Claiming, this is chapter 1, verse 22, claiming to be wise, They became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, for that reason, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts, to impurity, to dishonoring their own bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. For this reason, God gave them up. Right? Over and over and over. Go ahead. Yeah. For what purpose, at what time, under what circumstances does God harden people's hearts? He hardens their hearts. He strengthens their resolve, if you will. It's probably a better translation. Strengthening their resolve when they have rejected his truth. Absolutely. So, the chosen obtained it, but the rest were hardened. Right? And then we can debate, you know, for another 2 millennia, when someone becomes chosen. But Paul goes out of his way, he goes out of his way in chapter 9 through 11 to demonstrate that being God's quote unquote chosen people, which is what the Jews are, they are elect. Can't wait till next time when we get to how the contrast between election and the gospel, but they are God's chosen people, and that's not enough. Right? So in that way of looking at being chosen, that's not enough. But here he's saying, well, the chosen obtained it. Well, of course they did. That's why they're chosen. Right? That's why they are the elect. They are the elect because they obtained it, and the rest were hardened. Why? Because they rejected it. Don't get the cart before the horse, right? You got to get it in the right order. So, that's, I know, more than just chapter 10, but chapter 11 is kind of long. So anyway, he's going to keep going on through here and making that contrast, again, between God's way, man's way, between Jew and Gentile, between faith and works. And he sets this up. He sets this up beautifully when he talks about, I'm going to make you jealous with those who are not a nation. I'm going to make you angry because of a foolish nation. Why? Because they, the Jews, rejected God's truth. So then he went to the Gentiles. And that is chapter 11 in a nutshell. So he already sets it up, and then we can finish that up. So how does this land? How does this land in your mind, in your understanding? Is this like, duh, old stuff, totally get it? Is this heresy? Or is this, that might be right, I need to study it more, or something else? How are you, do you wrestle at all with these things? Because I know that there are lots of people who have fought, as you say, bloody battles. Maybe not bloody battles, but symbolically bloody battles, certainly, over issues raised in chapters 9, 10, and 11. Are we good? Are we low on coffee? Are we hungry? Ready for lunch?
So one thing that's important, as you look at this, and you recognize, I think Kyle and I were talking a little bit about this recently, where you've got to understand, first off, the immediate audience. Who are you dealing with? You cannot miss the fact that this is where Paul is reiterating over and over and over again to these Jews, you don't understand. You're not getting this. You don't get what is available. And he's trying very hard, and we've already established, and he's trying very hard to help them see the significance of the hope that exists in Jesus beyond just what they know.
Right.
So one of the things that then we export, and I think one of the problems here is that when we export this theology, we try to attach it to our own current experience. We think, okay, well, how does this connect to what we know? For many people, there is this assumption that we sort of represent the Jews now, right? There's that replacement concept. We're now in the covenant. Those of us who have been saved are in that promise. And interestingly enough, the people that do that then take on a lot of that Jewish problem, right?
Yeah.
What's the issue with the Jews? Well, they think they've got it. Well, we got it. We're good. We're in. You're out. Because, you know, we're chosen. And the same problem, the same difficulty that they were facing, the Jews were struggling to understand this, that same thing then also gets exported, where we think, okay, well, obviously we're good because we're elect or whatever the case may be.
Right.
However, we want to use that language. I think much of the instruction that's here, at least for me, is to remind us of the fact that the same pitfalls that existed for the Jews exist for the Christians now. We have a lot of the same tendencies where we
Absolutely.
Come to this conclusion that we somehow have some type of special privilege and we don't have the, well, yeah. So I think that's part of the issue, that you draw that correlation between the two, and that's where the fight comes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's true both inside and outside of the church.
Right.
I mean, we have that we, they mentality that goes all the way back to the garden, right? I mean, that's where we're better because X, Y, or Z, and they're not worthy. They're not worthy of God's favor. They're not worthy of God's love. They're not worthy of redemption because of whatever, anything. And you're right, we have exactly the same tendencies. We want to be in the club, and we don't want anyone else to be in the club. But that's not the gospel, right? The gospel says, whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. It's available for anyone. God's love, God's grace, God's mercy is available to all of us equally. And that's a big thing. That's the only thing. That is the thing. Right? That's the gospel. What else? What else do you see? Any other contributions? Questions, concerns? What is true? What is true for you from this passage? What is true about you from this passage? Nothing? Go ahead. Yeah. No? I see people go... And then hiding. Like, no, I don't want to say anything.
I'm going to keep talking.
Yeah.
There's a sense in which, as you look at this, you understand the heart of Paul. Paul has seen this stuff. And you got to remember who's talking to. If you think of Paul, you mentioned it a little bit when you were speaking about the fact that Paul knows the sentiment. Look how far Paul went to pursue what he possessed genetically. I mean, as a Jew, he was 100% in. And he was so committed to that he was willing to go out of his way to kill people that were presenting a different gospel, a different take on what was being taught. And God so radically transformed him. I find satisfaction, great satisfaction, to think the guy who was the champion of the Gentiles, the one who came along and said, "You Jews don't get it," is the one who had to be knocked off a horse by the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the grace of God that's there, I mean, we sometimes forget who's talking. And how far removed was he from that experience? Not that far. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that this was that he was in the other boat, so to speak. He had been there. I've been there. I know what you're thinking. You cannot wrap your mind around this reality. But let me tell you, it is so much better, much more than you could possibly even imagine. I've seen it. I understand it. And to me, that motivation that comes from that experience, he was knocked off from his proverbial high horse, proverbial linen, something literal, high horse as a Jew. And God told him, there's a difference. There's a different gospel that you don't understand. And as he becomes a champion of that gospel, I mean, and it's not even just in the face of the Jews. It's also even in the face of the church. What was Paul's main role within the early budding church? It was to challenge them against the heresy that sort of was being introduced into the system that said, well, okay, fine, we'll let a little bit, but you still got to be ultimately, it's really about being a Jew. And Paul says, no, it's not. And he withstands to the faith people who are way up in the system to remind them of that truth. So here's the point for me as it lands in my heart. God uses those experiences that he brings us through, and his intention as he destroys our presuppositions or our ideas about what's true, God's intention is not just for us to be amazed by that, But it goes back to sort of what you were talking about even earlier. We're supposed to tell other people. And there's such a strong sense of Paul's desire, evangelistic fervor. Go tell people what is true about his gospel. If you are changed, if you are radically transformed by the nature of the gospel, if you have been a recipient of God's grace, where he has taken you from the kingdom of darkness and made you his joint heir with Christ, does that not compel us to go and tell others? I'm ashamed that how often we adopt that same mentality. Great, we're in. Cool. Close the door. Hope nobody else makes it. And I know we would never say that, at least out loud, but our actions communicate that at times. That pierces my spirit. We have got to do a better job of telling people what is true about what the gospel has accomplished. And that's really what Paul's doing. He's basically giving his testimony. This is what I discovered on the road to Damascus. This is what is true about the gospel. Please accept and understand it. And he's so urgently anxious to get it. And that should be us.
And the Gentiles, too.
Right. Get it at the Gentiles,
right? Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Anyone else? Bonnie. Absolutely. That's great. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
This morning we were talking about obedience. And in many ways, obedience is a matter of faith.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you live under the Lord, I am no longer going to live my stuff on this. I'm going to live my faith.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a matter of faith to live in obedience. Go ahead.
And that's so hard. I mean, some obedience is relatively easy. I'm discovering with my kids, I see myself and my children more and more, which isn't a good sign. But for them or for me, the thought is that, you know, it's easy to obey in things that you sort of understand or that you're okay with. But to come to the place where God essentially takes your entire heritage and says, you got it wrong. So what does that mean practically? For these Jews, what are they faced with? A reality that the entirety of their system, this exclusivity that they sort of leaned on, this patriotism, for lack of a better way, a nationalistic mentality, was completely wrong. How do I obey that? I have to throw out more than just a little thing. I almost have to get rid of a culture and adopt an entirely new culture. That is difficult. And for the believer, we're willing to obey the small things, but when God's requirement, the gospel, asks us to get rid of a culture that we're very comfortable with, that we're very familiar with, that obedience is difficult.
I'm going to be traveling in a room, a Hindu yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah, thrown out of the home.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and they have to adapt to a completely radically different belief system. Because they know that they have found the truth, that it is going up against everything that they have to do.
Radical obedience, and that's just to shame a lot of what we call obedience. Sometimes we're so, it's difficult for us to be small.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that our job is to obey God's call, right? To do what God asks us to do. And it doesn't matter what that is. It doesn't matter if it's a quote-unquote big thing or a quote-unquote little thing. The requirement is still the same, to seek God first and to follow in his way, and that's it. And it's really that simple. It doesn't mean that it's easy, but it's simple. It's just do what God asks you to do. Whether that's, you know, abandoning your family and your culture, or, you know, or something that you find to be very easy to do. Either way, he gets the glory, and either way, we are still called to the same obedience. I was struck when we were reading Deuteronomy 29, verse 18, where he says, "Beware lest any among you, beware lest there be among you a root bearing poisonous and bitter fruit, one who, when he hears the words of the sworn covenant, blesses himself in his heart, saying, 'I shall be safe, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart.'" You know, that's sobering, and a lot of times we kind of like to do that. We kind of like to say, "Oh, I'm in the club, so everything's good." And even in the establishment of the covenant, Moses is saying, you know, the voice of God is saying, just being on board with it, saying, "Yeah, I'm kind of in the current of the way this is flowing," is not enough. And that's true for us today too. Just to say, "Yeah, I agree with that. That sounds like a good plan, so I'm good." Or, you know, they'll get your ticket punched and then live however you want. That's not it. You know, read the book of James. That's not enough. And we'll get a little bit more into that in a few weeks. I'm away next week, and then the following week, Mike will be teaching again as well. So for 2 weeks, we'll be doing something else, and then we'll come back and finish out Romans 11 after that. So keep studying Romans. There's a lot here, and you know, the climax is still coming. I mean, there's been a lot of awesome stuff. There's still more left over in chapter 11, so good stuff. All right, let's pray. God, we're so thankful that you are the same yesterday, today, and forever. And we are thankful that you are holy, that you are nothing like us, God, that we can bring you down to our level. But you are holy, and you are so much more than we can even wrap our minds around, God. And your majesty and glory is so much greater than what we can perceive or understand. God, we're so thankful that you have devised our universe at your command, and you have ordered things to follow your will. And God, we know that ultimately your will always be accomplished. So we pray that we would have eyes to see, God, ears to hear, so that we can accept your truth. And God, give us hearts to follow you wholly, to pursue you with everything that we have. God, so that all these other things will be taken care of in their own time because of who you are. God, help us to faithfully and fervently accept, enjoy, and pursue the covenant that you have made with us. God, knowing that truly from you and through you and to you are all things. God, help us to choose to walk in your path. Make your spirit be ever more alive in us, that we can put to death the deeds of the flesh, so that we can experience more of who you are and what you have for us through Christ. Amen.